I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Why wouldn't you dedicate yourself to public service?
Because I think it's a very mean life. I would dedicate my life to this country, but I see it as being a mean life. And I also see it as somebody with strong views and somebody with the kind of views that are maybe a little bit unpopular, which may be right, but maybe unpopular, wouldn't necessarily have a chance of getting elected against somebody with no great brain but a big smile. And that's a sad commentary for the political process.
Television, in a strange way, has ruined that process, hasn't it?
It's hurt the process very much. I mean, the Abraham Lincolns of the world. Abraham Lincoln would probably not be electable today because of television. He was not a handsome man, and he did not smile at all. He would not be considered to be a prime candidate for the presidency, and that's a shame, isn't it?
That was Hollywood reporter Rona Barrett interviewing 34-year-old Donald Trump back in the early 1980s. She was the host of Rona Barrett Looks at Today's Super Rich. And that's how our guest, James Poniewozik, the New York Times TV critic, begins his new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. He traces the rise and evolution of both Trump and TV and argues that television had a big hand in making Donald Trump president of the United States. That's because it went from several channels to multiple channels, from Barney Fife and Hogan's Heroes to Tony Soprano and Breaking Bad, from benign programs like, say, Queen for a Day to The Apprentice, and because of the rise of cable TV news. Poniewozik writes, cable, like Trump, sought out conflict, rewarded provocation, framed life as a continual win-lose struggle in which someone was always up and someone was always down. Well, we invited James Poniewozik to join us on Radio Times, and he's up in the NPR studios in New York City. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Marty.
What did Rona Barrett know that others didn't seem to know back in the early 1980s?
I thought it was so revealing that it was Rona Barrett who first had the intuition to ask Donald Trump, before he was even constitutionally eligible to run for president, by the way, whether he might be president. You know, I think that, you know, she was often dismissed as a gossip columnist, you know, somebody who did sort of the fluff part of the news. She did what she did very, very well. But she also intuited, I think, in a way that political journalists sometimes don't, that celebrity and a media presence and glamour were as much a route to power, becoming as much a route to power in America as traditional political qualifications. You know, I think you saw this mirrored in many ways in the 2016 election, where a lot of political reporters and pundits were dumbfounded by Trump's rise because I think they weren't necessarily attuned to the cultural forces that had made his rise possible. And I also thought, you know, because I wanted to approach from a television standpoint this question of how did we get to the point where the guy from The Apprentice could become president, I found it very interesting that, you know, he says at that time, somebody like me could not get elected in a television era. And the thing is, at that time, I think he was absolutely correct. Something had to change in the culture, and something had to change through television before we had a media environment in which somebody like Donald Trump could rise strictly through television and move directly from, you know, the NBC 9 p.m. time slot to the White House.
Well, and I do want to talk about all of that because it's a fascinating evolution for both television and also for Donald Trump. But I think it must be said that he understands television maybe better than television critics. Do you agree with that?
I think that he would probably, you know, I think that he would probably make a sharp television critic. You know, he has an intuitive sense of the medium. He knows what it wants. He knows what works and what doesn't work on it. You know, the whole notion of, you know, Abraham Lincoln not, you know, coming across in a glossy TV format, I think, is an inarguable observation. And, you know, he has proved in a lot of media that he is able to play to the camera well, that he knows how the camera works well. He's often sort of his own best producer in many ways, and he is certainly an attentive observer of the medium.
Would you say now we are all viewers of the Trump show?
We're all viewers of the Trump show, and we're all inside it as well, because, you know, what we've moved to is this point where this president who is wholly of, by, and for television, and a voluminous consumer of and reactor to television. He is the subject, star, and principal audience of this, you know, this TV production, where the news cycle and therefore, you know, the actual news, the actual world that we live in, is often determined by his relationship to television. Even if you don't watch cable news, you are still inside this show that is, you know, that is produced 24 hours a day for and by this audience.
Could we call this a love story between a man and a medium?
I think that he has had, you know, a deeper draw affection towards celebrity and the camera than just about anything else in his life. Sure, absolutely.
Well, and it
I think I think they get each other. You know, it's like, you know, you say love story. There is kind of a bond between him and the camera. I think they sort of think alike.
Well, we listened to him, and he was a young man at the time being interviewed by Rona Barrett. And shortly after that, he appears on the Today Show being interviewed by Tom Brokaw. Let's give it a listen, and we'll talk about it.
Mr. Trump, what's left in your life? You're 33 years old. You're worth all this money. You say you didn't say that you want to be worth $1 billion.
No, I really don't. I just want to keep busy and keep active and be interested in what I do. And that's all there is to life as far as I'm concerned. I really am not looking to make tremendous amounts of money. I'm looking to enjoy my life. And if that happens to go with it, that's fabulous.
What's so interesting about listening to Donald Trump as a young man is he's a little bit boring, mm-hmm. A little bit low-key. He's not the more bombastic talker that we hear today as president of the United States. What do you hear in those early interviews?
Yeah, as I say, you know, in the book, this is sort of the birth of Donald Trump, the television character. And television characters evolve over time. You know, if you watch a long-running sitcom, you know, often the characters will become more extreme or more softened, et cetera, et cetera. And in this case, I think you see some of the, you know, the key elements of, you know, sort of the character Bible of this character, you know, wealth, a certain amount of confidence and so forth. But it's a much softer tone, as you say. It's more ingratiating, attempting to be kind of, you know, seductive, trying to diffuse controversy rather than invite controversy. You know, if you just listen to that clip, substance aside, and just listen to the tone and the rhythm of it compared with Trump on The Apprentice or Trump today, it's very different. And I think that is as much about the medium as it is about Trump. That is, back in those days when television was this more homogeneous three-network medium, the tone of shows had to be different. One's presentation had to be different. And you're hearing not just the voice of young Donald Trump there. I think you're in many ways hearing the voice of 20th century media.
You did interview Donald Trump at Trump Tower. What was that like?
I interviewed Donald Trump at Trump Tower, not during his presidency, but when he was about to launch The Apprentice. So, you know, I did not go there with any thoughts that I was meeting a future world leader. You know, I was meeting the guy who I knew as an 80s celebrity who was sort of relaunching his career on a reality show. You know, one thing you're struck by going into Trump Tower and into his offices is just that so much of the experience is intended to kind of magnify him. You know, you walk in through
gold, right?
Gold and glitter and brass and marble and all these signifiers of wealth, luxury, power. His name is in 3-foot-high letters above the entrance. You ascend, you know, you go into a gold-plated mirror, and it's like, you know, you're ascending to the pearly gates. I walk into the office. He hands me a little printout of a Crane's New York Business article. It says, James, I just, you know, so you know, I'm the largest developer in Manhattan, you know, but by way of saying I don't need to be doing this show out of desperation. The article didn't actually say that, but, you know, the point he was trying to make was made. I mean, he struck me at the time, you know, this was not so much, you know, somebody with designs of world leadership as, you know, a celebrity who wanted to rekindle his flame and get attention.
Well, as you said, when he appeared on the Today Show, that the sort of television character of Donald Trump was born. But you also write, and I do want to play a clip from his first appearance on the David Letterman show, that he appeared on Letterman something like 30 times. This is the first time he appears, and it's December 1987.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the author of this book right here, Trump, The Art of the Deal, Donald Trump. Good to see you. Nice of you to stop by.
Thank you, David.
You know, at the beginning of the show, I said you either love him or you hate him. Now, do you find that that's true, or does everybody love you, or does everybody hate you?
No, most people love me, and a few really have great distaste for me, David.
Uh-huh. And why is it that those people, that few, would not care for you? Because you're so successful?
I can't imagine. No, I don't think so. It's just I sort of speak my mind a little bit like you in that respect.
Uh-huh, yeah.
A little bit like
you. A little bit like me.
Not too much, hopefully.
How much are you worth right now as you're sitting right here?
Zero idea, David. It depends on what's happening with the world and the market. But the $1 million for each person in the audience sounds like it could be an intriguing idea.
Yeah.
And it must have been a reference to his money and the thought of giving everyone in the audience $1 million. James Poniewozik, why was he on David Letterman more than 30 times, do you think?
His business was being a celebrity, first and foremost. When he went into business, one thing he made this comment to a biographer at one point, that he decided, I'm going to go into real estate, but I'm going to bring show business into real estate. And that means that he established himself as a celebrity before, you know, say he built Trump Tower. He understood intuitively that in a media culture, it is more important to appear like a thing. In this case, the image of, you know, big, brash, fabulous, luxurious success than it is to actually say be the most successful business in New York, because you can take that seeming, that appearance, that brand, and leverage it into any number of other areas, be it developing buildings or a career in Hollywood or, you know, ultimately a career in politics. And certainly talk shows, number one, are a great means for doing that. You heard, you know, David Letterman starts talking to him,
sure,
you know, kind of prodding, coaxing him to tell us how rich he is, which sort of generates. And this was a thing that went way back to the days when he was getting the New York tabloids, and the columnist would say, you know, Trump would talk to you about anything. The only thing he cared about was he had to say he was a billionaire, which he was not at the time. But, you know, it creates this reverberation of associating him with wealth and glamour in the public mind. And it also establishes him, and he's sort of learning his chops as an entertainer, which he was for very much of his career. And to, you know, jump forward a little bit to, you know, the election and his presidency, you know, you hear the thing about him where people say, you know, oh, take him seriously, but not literally. He's always thrived in these areas where there's kind of a borderline between, you know, irony and seriousness. I'm joking, but I'm not joking. And that is, you know, that is where people like David Letterman live. And that was where he established that personality.
Let's take a short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's James Poniewozik. He is TV critic for The New York Times, author of a new book called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America, telling parallel stories about the evolution of both Donald Trump and television. You can join us 1-888-477-9499, Radio Times at WHYY.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain, talking with James Poniewozik. He's up in New York at the NPR studios there. He's a New York Times television critic and, again, author of a new book called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. We've been talking about Donald Trump's sort of evolution through television into the 1980s, but 1980s is also when cable news begins itself. Help us understand what, I guess, the appeal was between Donald Trump and cable news. And I'll just quote you here. You say he was a one-man solution to the problem of what to do when there's no breaking news. The news was breaking as long as his lips kept moving. And perhaps that's the answer to my question, but go ahead.
Sure.
Sorry about that. Yes.
No. That's you are free to quote my book as much as you
I
like.
Figured,
I will never complain about that. But to unpack it a little bit, you know, I'm a big believer as a television critic that, you know, in order to understand America, you have to understand television. In order to understand television, you have to understand a little bit about why it is the way it is as a business. You know, and cable news is a business just like the rest of television. What's on TV is what makes money. Well, how is cable news and why is cable news different from, you know, broadcast news of the old era when you aired a half hour of nightly news every night or whatnot? Cable news is 24 hours. And that means that its business model requires not just digesting the news of a 24-hour period and selecting the most important story, but persuading you that the most important thing is always going on right now, keeping people tuned in, giving people reasons to tune in, and making them excited and agitated even when there aren't things going on. Now, this is obviously a format that goes long back before Donald Trump was on cable news. You know, from the earliest days of CNN, you know, as much as CNN distinguished itself, say, in the Gulf War, you know, when it had round-the-clock coverage of the bombing of Baghdad and so forth, it also was pioneering things like Crossfire, where you're sort of creating drama through arguments with people. You know, that's just a big part of the business model. If there is not excitement, you have to create your own. Well, Donald Trump, as a presidential candidate, is somebody who understands the need of the beast to be fed. And because he is not tethered to a lot of the proprieties and sort of customs of a lot of the other candidates, he will say whatever. He says, you know, outrageous and offensive things. And that's news. It's news partly because, you know, simply nobody's seen this in a presidential candidate before. And it creates this effect where he garners attention even if he's not doing anything. You know, famously, CNN would run footage of his empty podium.
Oh, I remember those days during the campaign. Correct.
Exactly. Because, you know, simply the fact that he might say something becomes news the way that cable news has sort of defined news, which is just something to get excited and agitated about.
Let me ask you about something called LOP, Least Objectionable Program. And this was, I guess, the early days of television where you wanted people to stay tuned, but you wanted them to stay tuned with Hogan's Heroes, as I mentioned earlier, or some of these more, by today's standards, these much more benign programs. What changed? And was it just more channels or something else?
Well, that's a big part of it. You know, again, this goes back to, you know, TV works because it does what works as a business. And back in the three-channel era of TV, yeah, you had this notion of trying to put on the least objectionable program because the notion was you wanted to not give people reasons to change the channel. This goes just to simple facts. Well, number one, it goes to the fact that you have a huge audience back then by today's standards. Every program, you know, needs to draw 20, 30 million people in prime time or it's a failure and it gets canceled. So that means you've got to, you know, sort of make things very, very broadly palatable. And, you know, there are just the simple mechanics, too, where it's sort of like, you know, the distance between somebody's couch and the TV is this moat that protects you. And if you keep them on your channel all night in prime time, then when they turn off the TV, your channel will still be on the TV when they turn it back on in the morning. So, you know, so all of this creates an emphasis on not, you know, offending anybody, not putting anybody off. Once you get into cable, once you get into not just cable news, but, you know, cable music, cable sports, cable entertainment, cable dramas, etc., it becomes more about giving people reasons to opt in. They have to seek you out. And that often means putting things on that are absolutely not for everybody, that turn off a significant amount of viewers, but they turn on a substantial portion of the segment that you're going after. And that is the beginning of this fragmentation of the media into niches and bubbles that is paralleled and often fuels that same situation in our society and in our politics.
Well, let's talk a little bit about The Apprentice. It made its debut. How many years ago was that?
That was 2004. 15 years ago. Were we ever so young?
Indeed. But it's interesting timing within Donald Trump's life. At that point, he was actually having serious business problems. He had declared multiple bankruptcies because of his casinos in Atlantic City, having problems in New York as well. What did TV then offer this businessman?
The chance for a comeback, you know, the chance for what he always wanted, which was to, you know, be the center of attention again. And very importantly, the reason that he got that chance was not so much anything he did as a businessman in the 80s and 90s, but what he did as the character, you know, the sort of cartoon of a businessman who kind of occupied this space in the public imagination. Because he had created surrounded himself with these fabulous props, because he had played himself on David Letterman and in, you know, cameos on The Fresh Prince and Home Alone 2 as this kind of, you know, public shorthand for fabulous wealthy guy. That makes him a natural choice for Mark Burnett, the producer of Survivor, when he's creating a sort of a version of Survivor in the business world, to cast as its host. Because Donald Trump was reality TV before reality TV existed, which is to say, reality TV is a genre of TV that traffics in broad, quickly apprehensible symbols, right? Survivor draws on all these images in your mind of a desert island. The Bachelor draws on all these visual cliches of love and romance. And likewise, The Apprentice didn't necessarily need the most successful businessmen in the world, because televisually, business is often very, very boring. It needed the best picture of a businessman, and that was Donald Trump. That was the whole point of him his entire career.
How popular was The Apprentice, and then it became The Celebrity Apprentice? How popular was it compared to other programs at that time?
It was super, super popular for a year. Now, if you ask Donald Trump, it remained that popular for the entire 14 seasons it was on the air. Any television critic who covered the TV business at that time will tell you that Donald Trump's propensity for exaggerating and or making up numbers as president was foreshadowed by his tendency to do that with his TV ratings when he was the star of The Apprentice. But for the first season, it was a legitimate hit. The last week of the first season, its finale was the biggest show on television that week. And it made Donald Trump, who came across, you know, again, has great sense of the camera eye, was, you know, very easy to, you know, kind of produce and package as the flashy businessman who had a catchphrase, "You're fired," mm-hmm. right? And what more powerful thing can you have in television than a catchphrase? He's like the Bart Simpson of The Apprentice. and he becomes a pop phenomenon. Then, as television tends to do, he became sort of overexposed. NBC programmed the show a lot. He kind of ratcheted up his performance on the show. The show became more and more about him. And the ratings slumped off pretty quickly, and then stabilized at a point where it stayed on the air for a long time as kind of a good enough show, but, you know, not that fantastic. But it had put him back on the map.
Well, let me play a clip from season 5, and this is 2006, where he actually fires Summer Zervos, who I should add later came out and accused him of sexual harassment. Trump fires her for sticking up for one of her co-contestants, calls her stupid for being honest and for interrupting him.
It was a complimentary giveaway. I don't think that was a bad decision.
What, giving away nothing? You know, Tarek, these people are laughing at you. I mean, I'm sorry.
You know what? Let me just say something really quick.
Why should you interrupt me when I'm knocking
because,
the hell out of
him? Interrupting
me when I'm knocking him, what are you doing to yourself?
Because I'm being truthful, and I'll always be truthful.
How stupid is that, right?
It's not stupid.
Here I am. I'm getting ready to almost fire this guy for being a horrible leader. And you interrupt me.
If I stay, I want to
say all the truth. And you were no great shakes yourself.
Summer,
you did a lousy job.
I'm so sorry.
Here I am. I'm getting ready practically to fire this guy. And you keep interrupting me and stopping me from doing it. And in the end, what Carolyn said to you is true.
I want him to be fired.
She said, what have you done? And you couldn't answer it. You know what, Summer? You're fired.
And again, a scene from The Apprentice. And James Poniewozik, I mean, you know, there's some Zervos. We can sort of put that out there. Also, Amorosa from The Apprentice works in the Trump White House for a while, and then they have a falling out. I can't remember if he fired her or she left, but there it all is,
potato,
right?
Potato, potato. Yeah.
Potato, potato, right.
Right. There has been, number one, you know, you go back and watch particularly the boardroom scenes of The Apprentice, and there is so much foreshadowing in retrospect of the tone and tenor and operation of the Trump White House, honestly. You know, just the chaos and the kind of the agenda spinning on a dime when, you know, Mr. Trump gets irritated about something. The contestants who are sort of falling over each other to ingratiate themselves to him so that he turns on one of their competitors rather than him. And, you know, you've seen in, I mean, Trump's White House has been, you know, as we've seen, sort of, it has kind of a symbiosis with reality TV, not just with himself, but, you know, Anthony Scaramucci, you know, went through the White House in, what was it, 11 days, and then goes on Celebrity Big Brother. We see Sean Spicer now on
Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, there used to be, what do they call it, you know, the revolving door between government service and lobbying, and now the revolving door goes to a reality TV stage somewhere.
That's James Poniewozik. He's TV critic for The New York Times. He's also author of a new book we're talking about called Audience of One, Donald Trump Television and the Fracturing of America. Let me read a couple of comments here. Candace says, I'm weary of giving this enfant terrible even more media attention, but I understand he is somehow president of the United States, but no thanks to all the media attention. An email from Harry, your guest has just explained in no uncertain terms why I do not own a television. An email from Cindy. It seems as if Trump has extended his reality show persona to the presidency. He always seems to be performance ready, especially at his rallies where it's all jokes and no substance. In fact, James, I guess I'll quote you again. I mean, you do talk about the fact that he is sort of the greatest TV personality that's ever been created.
Certainly the most influential TV personality that's ever been created. You know, there have been a lot of great characters created in TV history, but, you know, Archie Bunker never got elected president, although Steve Bannon actually referred to Donald Trump as a compliment as Archie Bunker.
Really?
So there is that. But, yeah, you know, I can empathize with some of your commenters. You know, I love television. I think it is a great art form, and it's great, given, you know, some of our greatest American popular culture of the last couple of decades. But, you know, we are all kind of exhausted by the media environment that we're living in. I get that. I also think that media environment is very influential, and it's influential even if you don't own a television. You
know, really?
Get back to my earlier
point. It still
seeps
in.
Yeah, because we're living in a reality whose metabolism is set by television because of this circumstance.
Let me quote something that Jeff Zucker said, CNN president. This actually goes back to last November, talking about the ratings for CNN because of all its coverage of President Trump. He said 2018 was the network's most successful year ever. He goes on to say, people say all the time, oh, I don't want to talk about Trump. I've had too much Trump. And yet at the end of the day, all they want to do is talk about Trump. Do you understand that?
Sure. It's the story of modern media. You know, the people complain about clickbait, but they call it clickbait because people click on it. And the president is clickbait. And you know, it has been a rising tide, not just for Fox News, but CNN, MSNBC. You know, the fact is, you know, if you look at the news from the standpoint of ratings as business, something doesn't necessarily have to be healthy for the body politic in order to be good ratings for them. You know, often it's just that unhealthiness and toxicity and anxiousness is what keeps people tuning in because they're worried. You know, and again, like I want to say, like people fixate on, you know, things like this for legitimate reasons and, you know, out of legitimate concerns. But it is also just commercially a bonanza for a lot of areas of the media.
It creates a dilemma, I think. I mean, you can call it clickbait or you can call it ratings or you can call it just, you know, people actually listening to a radio show or tuning in and watching TV or even reading a newspaper. You cannot get away from ratings, but this sort of obsessive coverage, and you mentioned during the campaign, and I have a TV on in my studio here, I remember watching that blank curtain, you know, waiting for President, then candidate Trump's plane to arrive to then speak before some, you know, some event somewhere. It's really some crossed into obsessiveness, it seems.
It has. And, you know, I also want to balance that with, you know, I think that CNN and other outlets have also done really fine and appropriately, you know, skeptical and tough coverage. Jake Tapper is great. I don't just say that because I'm on the radio in Philadelphia. I think in every field, it is, you know, I'm focusing on cable TV because I'm a TV critic. But, you know, journalism is a business, but it's also a, you know, a vocation. It's a service. And part of that service is focusing attention on things, not just because it will get a lot of eyeballs, but because it actually matters. And just the fact that, you know, as you say, some wild, outrageous thing might come from behind that curtain is not necessarily reason to cover the curtain.
I mean, as much as we learn that the president or hear that the president essentially watches TV pretty much all day or certainly in the morning, but that's also true for the rest of us. I mean, I don't think we watch. I think the average is something like 3.5 hours a day. If there were no TV, James Poniewozik, would there be a President Trump?
Oh, yeah, he would not. I mean, I suppose he'd exist in some form without TV, but, you know, he would certainly would not be president if TV didn't exist. You know, he didn't get elected president because he was a real estate businessman. You know, there are a lot of real estate businessmen who, you know, don't have a media presence and therefore would not be plausible candidates for the presidency. So, I think it's no doubt without TV, there's no Trump.
We're almost having a break here, but it also says something about us as an audience, as viewers, is that we like this stuff. We want this stuff.
And we want this stuff even if we don't like this stuff. You know, again, you know, negative attention, positive attention, it's all attention and it's all ratings.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, James Poniewozik is our guest. He writes about television for The New York Times. He's also got a new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump Television and the Fracturing of America. We want to hear from you about what you make about this rather symbiotic relationship between television and our president. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, and if you're just joining us, our guest is New York Times TV critic James Poniewozik, author of a new book called Audience of One. And just a recap here, he says that understanding the evolution of TV from bland, generic programs to conflict-driven reality shows, anti-heroes like Tony Soprano's sports programming, like sports professional wrestling, and also the rise of cable TV's 24/7 news coverage is a way to understand how Trump became president of the United States. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We were talking about CNN, but I do want to talk about Fox and President Trump and even candidate and even businessman Trump's really unique relationship with Fox. Help us understand that.
This was really one of the most eye-opening things to me researching the book. I mean, even as somebody who, you know, covered Trump as a television figure and who follows cable news as a TV critic, until I really went back in the archives and looked at all of Trump's appearances on Fox News before he ran for president, I was not really aware of the extent to which he had this entire parallel television career while he was hosting The Celebrity Apprentice, which originated with Fox bringing him on as a guest, specifically Fox and Friends, where he had a weekly call-in show for 4 years, up until the day before he announced his run for president, Mondays with Trump. And Fox and Friends, you know, as we all know, that's Fox's morning show. It's a show that one of its own executives once described as, quote, an entertainment program that does some news. Well, you know, Donald Trump was an entertainment figure who dabbled in some politics. And this was sort of a perfect environment, kind of a zone that's sort of halfway in this netherworld between, you know, between entertainment news and actual news. That's a perfect platform in which to transition and port over this character from the world of entertainment and gradually turn him into a sage political figure. So he would come on, you know, like reality hosts do in a lot of morning show segments that day and talk about why he'd fire Gary Busey or whatever. And then he would rip on the Obama administration over Libya, you know, or border policy or something like that. And gradually the political component becomes more and more pronounced until, you know, by 2012, the Republican political candidates are lining up to kiss his ring because this TV guy, because of his connection with the Fox base, has become, and which was partly generated by the birther crusade that he had launched in the interim, had become a force within the Republican Party.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the birtherism trade. I mean, it was a totally fake thing that he and others were promoting on Fox. But it seems like that was kind of a perfect fit for both the man and also the medium.
It was a perfect fit for the man and also the medium. And it was also an instance, sort of the first instance of something that is also significant to Trump's media, political media presence, which is the merging of his Twitter brand with his TV brand. Because it's, you know, it's important to note, he first started talking about birtherism on Twitter. Before TV, this was, you know, something that was, you know, just it was too racist and out there for any Fox host to touch, until it became a news story because Trump was going off on Twitter, where you have no producers to pull you back or, you know, direct you to another topic, and flouting this conspiracy that had come from, you know, paranoid corners of the internet, and suddenly it is covered on TV. And, you know, that is sort of it turned out for him to be a way of political messaging and bonding, because there was an intense base of people who were really antagonistic toward Obama and whom this racist conspiracy appealed to them. And, you know, by embracing it and having a media presence embracing it, this is Trump saying, I'm totally of you. I'm not like those other Republican politicians who kind of treat you like a crazy cousin. I believe all the stuff that you believe. I feel all the anger that you feel. I even, you know, believe this wild conspiracy.
Well, you know, you mentioned Gary Busey and also talking about the whole, you know, birtherism, fake news. And that truly was fake news. I'm also thinking of the correspondence dinner when Obama essentially humiliated Donald Trump in front of people. It was, I think, probably on CNN, but I got a fair amount of play on TV. And I've interviewed a number of reporters who say that was the moment that Donald Trump thought, I'd like to run for president. Does that make sense?
You know, not only reporters have said it, but Omarosa said it. And seriously, I'm not joking. Like, I think that is somebody who actually has a very good insight into Donald Trump's mentality. Yeah, he'd played with the idea of running for president before, of course, going back as far as, you know, not just that Rona Barrett interview, but 1998, 2000. You know, certainly it cemented. The funny thing was, when that happened, this was sort of treated in the press as this great embarrassment and humiliation for Donald Trump. And, well, here was Donald Trump, who had tried to get involved in politics this crazy way, and he was totally humiliated, and that's it for him. But within this Foxiverse, where he had created this connection with this, you know, conservative base, in a way, it elevates him. You know, number one, he is the subject of this story and this controversy. And he is, you know, he presents himself, you know, he's still going on Fox and Friends. He's still unbound. And it creates this sort of sense of, you know, grievance, which has in many ways fueled his campaign, which was very much a cultural campaign. Right. They're laughing at me. When they're laughing at me, they're laughing at you. You know, aren't you sick of these people laughing at us? Well, you know, I still believe you're right. I'm still on your side. And it, rather than being a setback, you know, however much it motivated his run for president, I think in a way it actually enhanced it. It enhanced his chances.
Let me play a clip from Fox and Friends. It happened to have been June 14th, 2019, and it was the president's birthday.
It is the president's birthday.
The president is turning 73 today.
Mm-hmm.
And he is joining us by phone right now. Good morning to you, Mr. President.
Good morning.
Happy birthday. How do you plan to celebrate?
Well, I think I'll just work, if you want to know the truth. When
nope.
You say celebrate.
Doesn't surprise us.
You got
to
have a cake or something.
Celebrate.
What about a cake?
Yeah, we'll have a little piece of cake tonight. But in the meantime, we're doing a lot of things. We're doing a lot of good things, a lot of things that are turning out to be very good for our country.
Right.
I enjoy that doing more. That's better than taking it easy.
Now, James, and to our listeners, a couple months later, a Fox anchor, Sandra Smith, angered the president, and he tweeted out, "The new Fox News is letting millions of great people down. We have to start looking for a new news outlet. Fox isn't working for us anymore." Did he just give
much,
it all away?
Yeah. You know, he kind of said the quiet part out loud there. Yes, as he tends to. He very much, you know, it says blatantly what a lot of people have basically assumed, which is that he, you know, he sees Fox as working for him and its job being to promote him. You know, and certainly there has been this political symbiosis between him and Fox. He often seems to get much of his, you know, advice and consultation from, you know, Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity. But, you know, beyond that, there's also just this kind of, you know, magic mirror relationship between him and Fox because he watches so much of it and gets agitated and tweets about it. And that creates news. And then he sees that news and he tweets about that news. And, you know, there's this whole feedback loop, you know, in many ways, you know, TV helped elect Donald Trump. But because he's so susceptible and influenceable by television, once he got elected, TV in many ways became president.
An email from Eno covering all of Trump's foolish statements gives him constant attention. By not covering his menial sputterings, he would not constantly be on news. And that's kind of a dilemma about having a conversation like this. Correct, James Poniewozik?
Yeah, I mean, it's also complicated because it's one thing when you're talking about how much attention should you be giving the host of The Celebrity Apprentice when he says X, Y, and Z. On the other hand, when it's the president saying X, Y, and Z, it does carry, you know, there's a different calculus. But I also think that, you know, we're at a point where this could kind of be dialed back. You know, I think it's not enough now just to say, well, you know, presidents have never said outrageous things like this as a public statement before. It's news because the president is doing it. Well, if the president's been doing that for the last 2.5 years, maybe not all of it is worth breaking into programming for.
So, again, we're back to this question of ratings, correct?
Yeah, you know, it makes the world go round. Yeah, and it kind of determines the world that we live in. You know, I think, you know, I don't think that it should be the role of cable news or anybody else to try to, you know, keep the president at a certain level of attention for, you know, a political purpose. I just think it's, you know, journalism's job to exercise journalistic judgment.
An email from Paul, I think daytime TV has dumbed down the general public and made possible some terrible things. Eleanor says, I used to watch TV news all the time, but I'm exhausted. It's overwhelming listening to the coverage of this president all the time. I have to limit myself now. Does that sound familiar to you, James?
Oh, you know, I've talking about this book, I've heard that sort of thing from a lot of people. I mean, I would, you know, just push back a little bit again as a TV critic, somebody who sees a lot of value in the medium. I know a lot of very, very smart people who watch TV. I'm just a believer in treating TV smartly and understanding, you know, even if you don't like TV, it is the nervous system of our culture. It's the forum in which politics take place. Even if you feel that politics should be above it, you know, this is the world that we live in, and there is a value to understanding it, and there is deep, deep peril in ignoring it.
Well, and there, I mean, powerful stories have moved human beings
yeah.
forever.
Well, exactly. I mean, politics is a contest of stories, you know, and TV didn't invent that. But I really believe, I say this, you know, at one point in the book, I mean, for one thing, part of Donald Trump's success in the Republican Party and, you know, what might, may have gotten him over the line in the election is partly that he ran what was very much a cultural campaign. It was, as you know, as much about sort of cultural totems and signifiers as it was about this policy or that policy. And if you don't engage in that, you know, if you don't recognize that politics is in part this cultural criticism battle of what is our story and what is our canon and whose stories need more prominence and who deserves to be lead and, you know, who deserves to be supporting characters. If you just cede that field, you know, somebody is going to, you know, go out and tell maybe a worse story, but they'll tell it more effectively.
You have a section in the book, I wasn't sure how to approach this, about how Rodney Dangerfield and Caddyshack, in a sense, helped give us Donald Trump. Can you explain what you're saying there?
So Caddyshack is this hilarious 1980 comedy set at a golf club. Rodney Dangerfield plays Al Cervic, a real estate developer, who is this tremendously wealthy, loudmouth, obnoxious, boorish rich guy who annoys all the sort of elite, stuffy, you know, uptight kind of, you know, important people at the country club. And he absolutely ran away with the movie. People love this character because he embodies this archetype, this sort of fantasy of, you know, this is what I would be like if I was rich. You know, I wouldn't have to change myself. I wouldn't have to change the way I talk to please other people. I would do as I want and say what I want. And I wouldn't have to care about offending anybody because nobody can touch me. And, you know, I am not saying certainly that, yeah, I have no evidence that Donald Trump ever watched Caddyshack, much less sat down and, you know, saw, you know, plotted this out as, you know, a thing that he could use in an eventual run for president. But once archetypes like that are out in the culture, they become part of the toolbox that you can use to sell yourself as a public persona. And one thing that Donald Trump traded on over the years was this notion, you know, often a media created notion of him as the blue collar billionaire, right? You know, riding on his private jet, but he's got a bucket of KFC with him. You know, that is that same sort of, you know, imaging that, you know, and again, you know, a lot of this is smoke and mirrors. You know, blue collar billionaire, he once said, if I was the son of a coal miner, I would have left the damn mine. So, you know, I'm not saying that is necessarily an authentic thing, but it created a picture of authenticity that really allowed him to connect with some people.
You also write that we need to understand the 1980s to sort of understand how all this happened. How come? How so?
Donald Trump, you know, for one thing, had the great luck, the great timing to sort of come along as a public figure right around the time that Reagan was elected. And culturally, the United States was moving away from sort of the populism and anti-materialism of the 60s and the 70s into an era where, you know, there was a more sort of open embrace of material culture. You know, Madonna's Material Girl, Alex P. Keaton on Family Ties, you know, where rich guys were once solely the hated villains in popular culture. Now you had people like J.R. Ewing on Dallas, you know, one of the most popular shows in America, who, you know, you hate him, but you love to hate him. And love to hate is kind of, you know, the first step toward love. And that allowed Donald Trump to jump on the stage and become one of those 80s pop culture embodiments of the material spirit of the age.
Well, we're going to end on that note. James Poniewozik, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And again, he is the TV critic, the television critic for the New York Times, and has a new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez is our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. And talking about the 1980s, here's Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, from their 1985 album, Brothers in Arms. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, man, yo-yos, that's the way you do it. play the guitar on MTV.